Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
What does the future hold for St. Louis, and how do we get there? This is Nothing Impossible on KMOX.
Welcome into Nothing Impossible. Michael and Travis with you, talking about St. Louis innovators, entrepreneurs, the folks who are on the vanguard of what's next in the St. Louis metro.
Yeah, and you know what, our show talks a lot about what's happening at the local scene, but there are times that what's happening locally also has implications globally.
Definitely. Last week, just 7 days ago, we talked about what's happening in Ukraine and how we know what's happening in Ukraine because of satellite images that have been taken by private firms that have been shared with agencies like the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency right here in St. Louis. Many of those companies with St. Louis presences now. And also that technology is leading to advances from St. Louis companies that are impacting our day-to-day lives with consumer products. And so we're going to get the lay of the land from Andy Deering with Geo Futures.
Speaking of, you know, day-to-day lives, remember when the day-to-day life of a young teen in the St. Louis region was going to the mall? That's not so day-to-day anymore. And these malls need to find new life. And you had a chance to check in with the folks to see what's going on out at the Chesterfield Mall. Can't wait to hear about that and how they're looking at repurposing that physical real estate into something else.
Yeah, the Steinberg Group, a local firm, has taken it over. We're going to find out what their plans are, not just, you know, in the next couple of years, but they want to build a downtown Chesterfield is what they're dubbing their eventual plans for the site. And, you know, I grew up right by Chesterfield Mall. I worked at a store, I won't name it, inside the mall during part of high school, folding clothes. And so I'm really interested to see what's going to happen to this space.
That just means that your closet and drawers at home are perfectly folded all the time. Is that right, Michael?
No, they're not.
Not at all.
No. I did too much of it then. I'm sick of it.
Well, we're going to wrap up this show, again, keeping it local with a local company here, Schnucks. You've probably heard of them. You've definitely shopped there. Schnucks helping to support early stage food companies. We're going to talk about a company out of Cincinnati that's getting their foothold in St. Louis, not just through Schnucks as a customer, but also Schnucks as a mentor.
Yeah, there's a pretty big grocer in the Cincinnati area from what I hear. And yet this food startup in that city found their first customer, a mentor really, when it comes to building a business. They found it in St. Louis.
That's the Midwest hospitality and charm. So we have a lot to cover. Stick around. We'll be right back with more Nothing Impossible right after this.
Now back to Nothing Impossible on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
All right. Well, malls, they are a changing. I don't know the last time I was at a mall, but we've seen malls get repurposed for art. We've seen them get repurposed as, you know, major food hubs. But what about entrepreneurship? Michael, you had a chance to check in with the folks at the Chesterfield Mall to hear about their vision for maybe new life in that space.
So let's find out exactly what's happening from Tim Lowe with the Steinberg Group. Before we get into the offer that's been put out there, what is the status of Chesterfield Mall, both the number of tenants that are in there now and the grand plans going forward? Where do things stand?
So the grand plans for Chesterfield Mall are to redevelop the mall into downtown Chesterfield, which is a high-end mixed-use urban downtown development that will include both residential and office, as well as some retail and restaurants, in a really cool kind of urban downtown setting. That process is ongoing. Ultimately, we have to go through an entitlement and a rezone process with the municipality, And we are in the process of doing that right now. You know, projects of this size take some time and they take some effort, but we're in the process of moving that project forward.
And in terms of the mall right now, you know, what's occupied, what's not? Do you have a loose percentage-wise about occupancy? And then what does this offer for the building as it stands at least now?
Yeah, so I don't know so much about occupancy. I think what the opportunity is that ultimately projects like this take some time to put together. And we had a choice to make at the very beginning. Do we just go ahead and tear the whole mall down and do we leave it open and try to, you know, benefit with some of the life that's left in the mall? And we chose to leave it open. So over the last year, we've been working on a program to provide, you know, incubation opportunities to, you know, small tenants and, you know, retailers, operators, storage people, you know, people who want to test the market, need some space on a short-term basis. And since we've got, you know, 2 or 3 years before we actually start tearing the buildings down to develop Downtown Chesterfield, we elected to try to reuse the mall for a good purpose. And that's see if we can, you know, create opportunities for entrepreneurs and people like that who want to come in and want to operate in the mall on a short-term, low-cost basis. And we've been doing it for about a year. And we're, you know, again, it's not about occupancy, but I think if you go in and you look at, you know, the parts, we have a section for people who need public interaction. And we've got a couple of sections that are closed off that are people who don't, like storage people and manufacturing facilities and things like that. So this is really just an opportunity to make that this opportunity a little bit more well-known, and that's why we're having the presentation tomorrow, which is to invite, you know, agencies that deal with entrepreneurs and small businesses to come in just to hear about the opportunity, see what the mall looks like, see what the opportunities are, and really just try to expand our reach and finding, you know, these small tenants who might like to operate out of Chesterfield Mall for a short time period to, you know, incubate their business.
People's frame of reference, or they may hear this and go, hey, that sounds like what Crestwood Mall did during their interim period before it was demolished, bringing in, seemed like that was a lot of arts organizations, and this seems more entrepreneurs. But can you elaborate more on how this may differ from what people are familiar with in that situation?
It's not that much different. I mean, it's the same philosophy, which is, you know, why you have the physical plan of the mall itself, trying to create, you know, a higher and better use that gives people who otherwise wouldn't have access to a property like this the ability to access it and use it. And Chesterfield Mall did something very similar, though theirs was more focused on art programs. You know, ours isn't that much different. I mean, we have some galleries in there that have art, showcase art, you know, provide opportunities for local artists. We also have, you know, real estate offices, and we have, you know, retail stores. We have pickleball in Center Court. So we're just being more eclectic as far as, you know, creating a more diverse opportunity set and letting people like that come in and be able to try to, you know, use the mall while it has some useful life left.
Sounds exciting. Well, we have more exciting content and discussion. Stick around for more Nothing Impossible right after this.
St. Louis Innovation with Michael and Travis. Nothing Impossible on KMOX.
All right, welcome back. We talked about geospatial quite a bit on this show because there's a big investment being made in the region. It is something that we're getting a lot of authentic traction around. And Michael, last week we talked a little bit about the events in Ukraine and movements of Russian troops and how geospatial technology is allowing us to know what's going on around the globe. We're joined today again by Andy Deering from GeoFutures. We're going to start with the global perspective and then bring it local. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's think about what's going on in Ukraine first. How is geospatial technology at play there, allowing us to know what's going on with troop movement?
Yeah, it's a great question. The thing is about geospatial technology and geospatial, I think the previous times I've been on, you know, it's how do we define geospatial and drive understanding of what's going on? And I think this is a great example of how geospatial technologies, automation, you know, sensors are all helping us make sense or helping bring some certain things to light. So, you know, specifically with Ukraine, and even, you know, one of the more recent headlines about, you know, 7,000 troops, you know, Russia basically said, hey, yeah, we're moving troops from the line. Well, guess what? There's satellites that are going overhead, and they're at, you know, there's a multitude of them going overhead, taking pictures of the Earth and actually validating what's happening. And so it creates almost a level of deeper transparency to where they were able to quickly realize within, you know, 24 hours wait, that actually wasn't the case. And oh, by the way, here's actually where the troops have been moving. They're actually moving closer to the line, or there's more troops that are moving. And so, you know, think about that, you know, in the ecosystem. You have companies that, you know, are launching satellites, that are building sensors to take pictures. And some of them are doing those at, you know, different image resolutions to be able to say, oh, that's a tank on the ground, or in general, I'm seeing some movement of things happening. And there's a lot of them that are up there that are helping detect that, that, you know, not only, you know, the large organizations like NGA here in town are being able to tap into, but even a lot of, you know, humanitarian organizations and others are trying to look at that and get a better picture of what's going on. So really the pictures are not lying on what's happening. And actually, you know, organizations like Planet Labs, you know, they have many satellites up there to where they can continue to orbit, you know, multiple times a day over a specific area to actually give you a better picture. You know, we're not quite there to have a camera there overhead all the time, but those pictures and those snapshots and being able to detect what's happening today is far better, you know, than it was, you know, 20, 30, 50 years ago from when, you know, other conflicts had happened like that.
Yeah, we were talking last week about how remarkable it is that they can say there are X number of tents, or not only do we know they've set up, you know, infrastructure, they've moved this massive equipment, but they're setting up field hospitals. Like the level of detail seems to be pretty remarkable.
Well, and, you know, you heard it many years back, you know, when Director Robert Cardillo at NGA said, hey, we've got, you know, we've got some exquisite technologies that are helping us, you know, detect things that are going on. We don't have enough human eyeballs to be able to monitor all the information that's coming in. So, I, you know, from a technology standpoint, this is where you see the introduction or the intersection of modern IT sorts of things directly impacting geospatial is how do we use things like machine learning algorithms to say, okay, I know what a tent, for example, or a field hospital looks like at these different types of, you know, resolutions. Now go and send that across, you know, petabytes of information and say, tell me what that, you know, tell me where those are, things are popping up, or tell me how, you know, where things are moving. You know, a tank was here one day, but now it's over here another day, but and the signature on that is the same. Humans have been able to do that for many years, and they are especially trained in that. Now those humans are working with computer programmers to say, here's what a tank looks like at different angles and different heights. And oh, by the, and now let's send a computer to help sift through all this imagery coming in to help us really and truly detect what's going on and do it at a velocity far greater than what it was, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's amazing to think about how that technology has advanced in just 20, 30 years, where it used to be a spy plane, you know, flying overhead, shooting some images, trying to get those back to a human to evaluate the images.
I mean, this hold is, on, we got to like get those said, developed first before we can get them back.
you have to go to the photo mart in the parking lot to get that stuff developed. But this, as Andy said, we're almost at the point of real-time imagery being available to folks. And so what, you know, what do you think, project out like 10, 15 more years, you know, what does the future look like and how does this technology continue to evolve?
Well, I think the industry, the opportunity is there's, you know, people, organizations are wanting that real-time information on what's going on. Even the 24-hour delay of, you know, hey, the satellite now is doing daily clips. Now we want an hourly clips or by the minute or real-time. That's a huge opportunity. I think you think about things like SpaceX, right, who was like the Uber rideshare of all of these sensors. You go back, you know, many years, that was always the challenge, is actually getting up into space. Now the challenge is not getting into space. There's many Uber rides and things like that are happening. Now it's getting that image. And actually the other part was the down transmit of that information used to, you know, just be a few what they call ground stations where that information would come down into and then be able to connect to the internet. Now you have Amazon that's developed ground stations as a service and they're located everywhere. And so that's not the problem anymore. The problem is going to be being able to make sense of all that information. So it's the modern IT problem of we've got too much information and how do we extract the value, or how do we ask questions of this big pile of data that's coming in and get the results that we need to that's truthful. And I think that's where, you know, we're 10, 15, 20 years, we look out is you're going to see way more applications for data scientists or high-end, architecture people that are focusing in on systems and those sorts of things to be able to analyze that. But it's not taking away from, you still have to have the scientists that understand the the why, or here's why, you know, this is important, or here's what troop movements look like in this specific situation, or here's what, in the agriculture sense, what crop health looks like from this type of a sensor. And so that's where, again, it's changing to a more IT or tech sort of a thing, but those same principles apply. And we're going to become a heck of a lot smarter in that process as well.
We're talking with Andy Deering, who's the lead for Geo Futures in St. Louis. And, you know, as we were going through the New York Times account of some of these latest images last week, we pointed out the name Maxar Technologies and said, if you listen, you've probably heard that before because of their expansion in St. Louis. What are some of the, you know, run through some of the big players in geospatial in the area, maybe names that we'll hear in the midst of this, or maybe names that people should stock away in their minds because they're going to hear in the future.
Yeah, the ecosystem, and actually the more of these organizations are coming into town because they want to be a part of what we're building and growing here. But the ones that you'll see and hear in the news, obviously NGA is a big part of this, and you'll either see them or you won't see them, you know, and they're bringing together all this information and doing the analysis. But their industry partners and what they're working with, Maxar is obviously a great one. And, you know, prior to that, and if you look on Google Maps, you'll see, you know, Digital Globe or whatever. So Maxar has got a lot of they're a conglomerate of those that are, you know, have different sensors for weather or for pictures and those sorts of things. And so you'll see them as a centerpiece for most images on CNN to, you know, all the other publications as taking those active shots. But then you have organizations, as mentioned earlier, like Planet Labs, who have a slightly lower resolution sensors, but they are rapidly, they got more of them, they got flocks of them that are orbiting and being able to give that real-time detection of things that are happening, and that revisit rates pretty heavily. And they're located here in St. Louis as well. But then you take, okay, it's great that we're collecting all that information, but then the, you know, how do we analyze it or using geospatial tools? Obviously, Esri is a big partner here in the region, with over 100 folks here that are supporting not only the federal government, but agriculture, and their tools are a key centerpiece to be able to do that analysis. You've got Hexagon, U.S. Federal, who's doing a bunch of imagery analysis, and they've got tools and capabilities on the tech piece. Then you have the other industry partners, there's many of them that are here, but you have organizations like General Dynamics and Booz Allen Hamilton and Leidos and others that are around here that are providing human power to help, you know, do that analysis or set up those algorithms or to do the work that needs to be done to extract the value out of that information that's coming in using tools like Esri, Hexagon, and then using imagery and data sources like Maxar and Planet. So it's a nice budding ecosystem around there. And the skills that we're building and growing to help support this mission are going to pay dividends down the road as we continue to build out what we have going on here.
When we think about, you mentioned a lot of the industry players, whether they're large industry players or maybe some that have entered into the market to really partner with the NGA. What are we doing within the startup scene? We just saw recently that, actually T-Rex has been engaged in this geospatial work for a number of years now, really since the announcement was made. But Andy, give us an idea of how the early stage and startup community is responding to this.
Well, there's, you know, the opportunities, and I always kind of date back, you know, the past 18 months since we released the GeoFutures roadmap that did cite that, hey, we need to do more around entrepreneurs and startups and providing capacity and, you know, capabilities for them. The great part is we've had a lot of assets that have been built here, and you cited T-Rex, and T-Rex, not only do they have their Geospatial Innovation Center, they house the NGA's Moonshot Labs, but they just signed a partnership agreement with NGA. And again, those types of agreements, and especially between NGA and a nonprofit like T-Rex, it's very similar to the MTC agreement, Missouri Technology Corporation agreement that was signed to allow for the NGA accelerator that's been in play. This, again, is another avenue for NGA to engage and to promote, whether it be, you know, startup resources, whether it be programming, whether it be even talent sorts of build up and creating talent in support of the NGA mission, but in support of the ecosystem that we have here. And T-Rex is a key centerpiece of that, and not only providing the resources that are capable, but now providing, potentially having funding that can help provide that or at least coordinate that across the region.
Well, speaking of the talent pipeline, and you mentioned the high school students getting involved with Gateway Global. Are there other ways that, you know, non-traditional talent is being brought into this industry and this sector?
Yeah, that's a great. You might have seen it recently in the news, but Rung for Women. I always, you know, they're a great example locally. You know, I bring the story up is that we put the GeoFutures roadmap out, and really it was a scale strategy. And so, you know, the way that I kind of term it is, we put a basically a big power strip out there with a lot of receptacles that people can start plugging into. And Rung for Women was a great example of that. They saw the opportunity. They obviously had their programming that was already in place, but they saw this opportunity and kept hearing about this geospatial industry. And they partnered up with Maryville University. And they said, hey, you know, we want to do something around geospatial, partnered up with industry partners like T. Carter and Maxar and others that are here locally supporting NGA, and said, can we build a geospatial track for our members of that organization? And they did that. We had no awareness from myself and the GeoFutures group. We didn't have any awareness that this was going on until they built it. And they were actually, you know, already starting the programming and building and creating opportunities for their members. And then they said, hey, we're doing this. You want to let, you know, and we promoted it. And we said, wow, this is amazing, the impact that you're doing. But then now fast forward, you know, 6 months, you know, they had applied for an EDA grant, and we're able to get, you know, $500,000 to be able to support and continue on that programming and really making that impact. And that's just one example of many, like Launch Code, like Claim Academy, like many other, you know, almost that upskilling or the non-traditional education pathways that are building up and growing around that, but are also making a significant impact in the neighborhoods where NGA is moving into.
Well, and just like, so we talked about how this has had this, you know, application with Ukraine and the national security implications, but just like NASA and Apollo led to consumer products, NGA, geospatial is too. Can you, and this is what we've talked about many times on Nothing Impossible, but can you remind us of some of those applications for this technology that people may encounter more in their day-to-day lives?
Well, you know, it's actually interesting, you know, from the Ukraine perspective, and I was, you know, watching, I don't know if it was Good Morning America or whatever on Friday morning, and I was, you know, I don't know, exercising or something, right? And I see the headlines coming through with Ukraine, and they have maps and overhead imagery and all this stuff that we're talking about. And then the next article is about Snapchat. And I was like, and it was about location services and helping on college campuses to protect students, and using location technologies for and enabling that to be able to track and be able to make that more aware and what's going on. And again, you're starting to see more. I'm just, you know, in 30 minutes, you're able to see two completely different use cases of location technologies. And behind that is partners like you see Mapbox locally, and they're one of the geospatial, you know, startups that are now, you know, getting ready to go public, and other organizations that are building technology capabilities, data, or, you know, a platform to where people can understand or answer that question about what where is. But I think as we start seeing, and again, we're, you know, in the midst of climate crisis and other things like that, understanding and where things are happening and why things are happening in those locations, geospatial is, you know, they say Google is the what, you know, geospatial is the where of this. And we're able to answer that question with a lot of the capabilities that we're building here. And the advancements in technology will only continue to accelerate that going forward and make it, you know, more normalize it for you and me, as we have great geospatial data sensors that we carry with us every single day with our mobile phones and help us better understand the world.
Well, Michael, this is it's interesting as we're chatting with Andy here, because these are the same types of conversations we've had. You could swap out location and geospatial and plug in food and agriculture and look at, you know, how the ecosystem within St. Louis has grown really around major players. In the case of agriculture, it was Monsanto, not now Bayer. And then early stage companies, and then the infrastructure that goes around it, whether it's BioSTL or the Danforth Center for Plant Science. Andy, as you're looking at these parallels, and I know that you talked about the roadmap before, but are there things from the BioSTL and the bio roadmap that you're also following here?
We've drafted that roadmap. And again, theirs was more of the early stages of plant life sciences was a growth strategy. A lot of these resources weren't here. So we're able to actually just bonus off of a lot of the investments that were already made here in the ecosystem. But I think the things that you're going to see, especially over the next couple of years, or even sooner, is bolstering up our research capacity. You mentioned the Danforth Center, and they are a world-class institution that's really focusing in on high-end research, bringing researchers here, which then in turn allows for startups or other things that help percolate the ecosystem here. that's something that we will see more money being piped into and helping develop research capacity here that not only advances the industry, will help, you know, recruit and build, you know, world-class researchers here, which will be great, but also the reverberations of what that actually means. Companies will want to engage and plug in, help solve problems. And then I think the next part of that will be, how then do you commercialize or build up that almost like that biogenerator arm for geospatial to allow for those, hey, I've got an interesting concept or idea. I want to now commercialize that and then have those resources there to really build up more startups here, not just services-based startups, which we have a lot of those here that support the geospatial ecosystem where it's people and small businesses that help support that. But now we're starting to see high-end tech companies that are growing and spinning out of these, you know, these hard problems or hard challenges or research projects and that are pushing the industry forward. And then that's when you're, again, that's, you know, I think that's where the investment and where some work's going to be done in the next, you know, 6 to 24 months is around growing that capacity here as well.
Well, Geospatial, just getting started in St. Louis, will continue to track it for you and bring you the latest. And thank you to Andy Deering, the lead of Geo Futures, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay tuned. We've got more Nothing Impossible right after this on KMOX.
Now back to Nothing Impossible on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Well, this next conversation might make you a little hungry. We welcome in the owner and founder of Creamalicious Ice Cream, Liz Rogers. Thank you so much for joining us on KMOX.
Thank you for having me. I certainly appreciate it.
And so this, I'm looking at the images and I'm so hungry already. It looks delicious. Tell us about Creamalicious and these 2-in-1 desserts that you have.
Yes, you can have the best of both worlds with Creamalicious. You do not have to choose. You can have it all. 4 generations of family-owned recipes from my grandmother and great-grandmother and my mom and my aunts, and just baked fresh and intertwined in a amazing super premium pint of French ice cream.
I am just freaking out looking at this Right as Rain red velvet cheesecake. But I'll let you kind of walk us through what the flavors are and maybe what your favorite is.
The Slap Your Mama banana pudding is our most popular flavor. It's really, the Creamalicious is extremely creamy. It's very, it's a super premium pint. So we do use real banana pudding puree in the pint with the cookies. So we don't use any artificial flavoring, no high fructose corn syrup. And it's really a culinary inspired ice cream. I am an executive chef and restaurateur by trade. So I get to really, you know, bring my culinary skills to the pint. And, you know, the whole thing was to really get the ice cream pint to taste exactly like a piece of peach cobbler or a piece of sweet potato pie, exactly what the dessert is. So it's really more than just a dessert. It's an experience for the consumer.
Can you take us, you gave us a little bit of a hint there of how you came to this, but you know, what's your background? How did you come up with the idea for this? And then really, how did you scale it?
Yeah, so I own restaurants, and we were always really selling a lot of desserts in our restaurants. And, you know, it could be any dessert. You know, for me, I try to do a little bit more innovation, desserts that you can't really find in other restaurants, and really wanted to hone in on my Southern roots from my family. So for me, it was just a task of really trying to get the dessert to taste like ice cream cold. So ice cream is the world's number one dessert. So, you know, it's like, if I can do something that everybody loves in a pastry kind of way, that would be really cool. So scaling it, you know, just really became making it inside the restaurant, getting feedback from the customers, selling it inside the restaurant, and then going to food scientists to create the formulas and recipes, then finding a manufacturer that can execute the formula and scale it from there.
And speaking of the scale and then getting it onto grocery store shelves, you're from Cincinnati. Your business is based in Cincinnati, but you're in St. Louis this week and you're visiting local Schnucks stores. Why is that?
Because Schnucks was really, you know, I feel like they were the champion for the underdog, you know. I'm the underdog, you know, cheers, you know, so it's one of these things where, you know, you walk in the store, you see all these giants on the shelves, these amazing ice cream brands that I've looked up to since I was young, you know, like Ben and Jerry's and Haagen-Dazs and Breyers. And you're just like, wow, you know, what would it be like to be on that shelf, you know, and knowing that my brands have a very amazing story. We're like Disney. We're the storytellers. You know, we bring the consumer into what's familiar. And if they can relate, you know, I'm one of the only chefs, if not the only one out here, that's the face of the brand. And I'm just a common person that had a dream, and it becomes tangible and it becomes relatable to the consumer. So Schnucks, you know, I really felt like they really resonated with my brand stories and what my brand actually represented. Their brand was extremely cohesive with what I wanted my brand delivery to be and my business model to be. So it was really a great partnership. So they really took a chance on me and gave me an opportunity. But not just that, just really helped me, you know, navigate through the retail system because it was very new.
Yeah. What is it like when you're trying to get that first shelf space? Are you just knocking on doors, cold calling grocers and retailers? And what was it about Schnucks that made them go, yes, we'll be the ones who give you the big boost, the first big break?
That's exactly what I did. You know, when opportunities don't come to you, you know, as an entrepreneur, you really need to create opportunities for yourself. I mean, all they can tell you is no. All they can say is no, it's not going to kill you. You just go to the next one, you know, and every once in a while, you know, you will find someone that believe in you, they believe in your brand, and that they're going to take a shot, you know, take a chance on you. But retailers need to also understand that that's a really big investment from my, you know, standpoint of the entrepreneur. You know, we're investing time and we're investing money and we're taking a chance as well, you know, and it's a two-way street from the partnership. And what I really loved about Scott over at Schnucks, he always answered all of my emails. He was so attentive and he treated me like I was a really big brand, and he gave me that respect and that confidence. So I was extremely appreciative of that. And I really appreciated the fact that they really are extremely serious about their diversity and their minority business that they're trying to build with the diversity supplier inside the stores. And I think that's just going to make it even better as far as inclusion.
We're talking with Liz Rogers, who's the owner and founder of Creamalicious Ice Cream, which looks amazing and is based in Cincinnati, but got its first big break at Schnucks here in the St. Louis area. And Liz is in St. Louis, stopping by local Schnucks. And we hear all the time from startups about how it's not just about the money, the investment, the grants, the first big customer, but it can also be about the mentorship, the advice, the direction that they sometimes get from investors and accelerator programs. And it sounds like Schnucks hasn't just been like, yeah, we'll buy your ice cream and put it on the shelves, but they've been this kind of in this mentorship role almost for you.
They have, you know, with regards to being an entrepreneur, you know, it's, you're absolutely right. It's really the money. Yes, we do need money to sustain the business, but it's not going to sustain the business. A correction. Money's not going to sustain the business. It'll get you started, but how long you last is something totally different. You really have to build a really good team. You need a team of advisors, an expert in the field. I have ice cream experts on my team with 30 to 40 years of consumer packaging experience. I have people on my team that have sat on some of the biggest brands boards. I have so much infrastructure that I'm not the smartest person in the room by far. A great deal of brilliant people around me, and you have to be open to learn. And with especially choosing a retailer, you know, because no one wants to fail, you know, but if you do, that's okay. You know, you can't be afraid to fail. You can't be afraid to take a chance and take a risk. If you're afraid to take a risk or a chance, you're really not an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurs at their core, we don't care. We're going to go for our dream every single time. And with Schnucks, it was just a little different because they really agreed to be in a partnership role and part of my team as it relates to that infrastructure that I needed to navigate through the ice cream world and just really building a good partnership so that when we do have other brands and I do have other flavors and other product lines, you know, they are my partner and they know how I work and they can help me at that point.
You know, Schnucks and innovation really have a long history. Have you run into, they're the first grocer to wide scale robots for inventory management. Have you run into the robots in the aisles?
I have not run into the robots yet, but I think that is so dope that I wish I had seen a robot when I was there. So that would have been really, really cool.
I know who you did see, though, and I'm wondering if Ozzie Smith did a backflip after he tried your ice cream.
He was very pleased with my ice cream, and I was so I felt so honored that he came to the store to meet me. That was just super, super cool. It's just the support and it's just, it was just really overwhelming. I kind of teared up a little bit. So I thought that was really cool, you know, with the family coming and everything. And, you know, Jill's been great. You know, Jill, like, she just had me all over the place today. I felt like a star today. So that was awesome.
That sounds amazing. Well, Liz Rogers of Creamalicious Ice Cream joining us on Nothing Impossible on KMOX. One last question. What's been your impression of St. Louis, especially from that business owner perspective? What did you think about St. Louis before you had the interaction? And now that you've had this impression, what do you think?
You know, I always thought St. Louis was this really, really big town, and it really is. And there's just a lot of moving parts here, a lot of different places here, just the culture, just a lot of diversity, a lot of entrepreneurs just waiting just to really get out here and make their footprint here in St. Louis. And I really do feel like there is a lot of promise. And I'm really hoping that entrepreneurs really get out here and just go for their dreams and just really live life deliciously. You know, that's all you can do. Just live deliciously, you know, because there is a dream in every scoop. I say that it's right there on my packaging. You just have to chase your dream until it comes true, you know, and the dream is, you know, sometimes the dream is bigger than us, you know, our vision, it's bigger than us, you know, so when you're out here doing things, you know, it has to be for something bigger than yourself. And I'm really hoping to be able to help other entrepreneurs as I got help from Schnucks and just the support. And I'm really wanting to support other entrepreneurs as well on their journey.
Yeah, paying it forward. We're talking with Liz Rogers of Creamalicious Ice Cream, one of the only African-American-owned national ice cream brands that's in mass production. And speaking of paying it forward, you've talked with some Harris Stowe students about entrepreneurialism.
I did. And they have some amazing ideas. I just think their ideas are just brilliant. And, you know, I spoke with them about just understanding that you do have brilliant ideas and you have to believe in yourself and you have to be your biggest cheerleader. And sometimes, you know, when that confidence, you can't expect to get that confidence and support from other people. It has to really, really start with you. And you got to go for your dreams. You know, what do you have to lose? You know, you don't want to, you know, live with regret, like what you could have done for the rest of your life. And, you know, we're not getting any younger. So, you know, you have to be able to understand that these kids, they're the future, you know, they're the visionaries. And through their visions, you know, we will be able to build and be more powerful than we ever could ever be.
Well, you can find Creamalicious Ice Cream in the freezer section at your local Schnucks, a yes. Startup that's nourishing people's souls. Thank you so much, Liz Rogers, for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
I really, you know, Schnucks has been a good partner in the region. They seem to always have this ability to not only engage with the startup community, especially around food, but provide mentorship, which I think was great.
Yeah, we talk about locally based companies and what are some of the intangibles that come along with having a business that calls St. Louis its home. And this is one of them, attracting other businesses here, making these connections, providing even some mentorship to fledgling companies that are growing up and being introduced to St. Louis. That's part of what you get from having a hometown company.
Yeah, and it really is that wraparound service that so many startups and early stage companies need. It's one thing to know what your product does and maybe how to take it to market. But once you go to market, a whole nother can of worms opens up. And so that mentorship is really critical.
And this is an example of, we interview so many startups and entrepreneurs and founders on the program. And this is one where you can just go to Schnucks and go to the freezer case and buy some Creamalicious ice cream. You're going to love it. And get a little taste of the startup community.
One scoop at a time, right? One scoop at a time.
Well, thank you for joining us for this edition of Nothing Impossible.
We'll be back next week. Make sure you check out the podcast on the Odyssey app.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.